Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 493.2CH0913, certificate number 2504, Fort Knox.
But of course, his government's given you a bomb.
I prefer to call it an atomic device. It's small, but particularly dirty.
Cobalt and iodine?
Precisely.
Well, if you explode it in Fort Knox, the entire gold supply of the United States will be radioactive for 57 years.
58, to be exact.
I apologize, Goldfinger. It's an inspired deal.
Yeah, just the way you said it.
It makes me excited.
Yeah. Are you a numismatist or a numismatist?
A coin collector, is that right?
Yeah.
I am not. What's the opposite of that? I'm a numismaphobe. I don't like having coins.
Really?
As soon as I get a coin in my pocket, I'm unhappy. They jingle.
Yeah.
That your pants kind of hang weird.
They do jingle. Your pants do hang weird, but I don't know if that's why.
You don't think it's coin related?
Even when you were a kid, you didn't like coins?
Oh, no. I actually did like coins as a kid, but I didn't have anything cool or rare. I feel like I missed the chance to have... What, quarters with silver in them?
Did you ever search through your pocket change and look for, do you know the dates of the coins that where silver was no longer in the coin?
I don't. I do remember having a few pennies that had the previous design. What do they have?
Like right, the little shield?
The wheat thing. Yeah. Are you a coin guy?
I always was. I just was interested in them, I think, at first because I was a kid that wanted his money to look like the most it could look like. It was, you know, money to me, it was a very Scrooge McDuck-based relationship to money. If you gave me
to swim around in it?
Yeah, if you gave me $10, I would have preferred 10 $1 bills.
Would you prefer 1,000 pennies?
Well, pennies, no, because you recognize, I think, that pennies are cheap.
They're a different color. They're brown.
Yeah, they're like the pennies don't seem like money quite as much. And obviously, bills are preferable. But I often would get my money in ones. I remember the first time I was able to go to a bank and get an actual banded stack of ones. I really liked my money that way. This was, you know, back at a time when I had $112 in my total wealth.
And they would put a little band on it for you?
Oh, well, you know, you'd get them in bands of packs of 20 or whatever, and I could have a little stack of... But I remember I think I had $100 that was banded, and it really felt like I was swimming in it.
Where did you keep your money? Did you have a hiding place?
Well, for a long time, I had a shoebox that was on the top of... the top of my closet. And, you know, my sister and I had chores. We had allowance. We'd do work around the neighborhood. You get money various ways as a kid. You know, you get a little bit at your birthday or whatnot. People give you a dollar in a birthday card. And my sister would spend all her money as soon as she got it. And I was the very opposite. Just hoard money.
We know about you even hoarding your fake grade school Ferrell's money.
I do. Then when I realized that there was a difference between coins that had been made at one point versus coins that had been made at another point, and that the that some U.S. currency made before 1967, I mean, it was majority silver.
And you did know which years were?
I did. And, you know, like Ben Franklin half dollars and Mercury dimes and quarters made before a certain time were made of silver. And then there was a, you know, a gradual sort of degradation of the silver content of coins, that more copper and zinc was introduced.
I understand most of those are entirely out of the money supply now because people got very good at sorting in bulk.
They did. But when I was a kid in the 1970s, you could find, and this was before the kind of the big inflation in silver prices and gold prices that happened in the 80s, which is another omnibus that we're gonna cover the Hunt brothers and the big silver boom in
we almost did it once, but it turned into onions.
Yeah,
in
that's
our
right.
Hands.
I started to research the Hunt brothers, and I was like, this onion story is way more interesting.
This often happens in omnibus preparation.
We'll get to the Hunt brothers in their time, but you could still find a lot of silver, real silver coins in pocket change, and anytime I would get a handful of coins, the first thing I would do was check the dates, check the mint marks, and separate them out. But, you know, coins that I thought were interesting and coins that I didn't.
Now, was there some kind of buyback program, or would you have to semi-illegally sell these to someone who would melt it down for silver?
Well, so it's against the law to melt it down.
Right.
But coins that were silver had additional value on the numismatic market.
Oh, so it's just collectors.
So there's always, people that are, so I own a lot of coins that have no collector value because they're too worn, right? That, you know, coins are graded according to a scale of how pristine they are. And these coins have absolutely no collector value in the sense that they're silver wears a lot harder, and you'd end up, these coins, some of them have very little definition.
Because you would sit and rub them
so
much.
I would, muhahaha. I mean, I would often lay on my bed, and this, I'm embarrassed to say it, my mom caught me doing this one time. I was laying on my bed and I was pouring my shoebox full of coins over my head and then putting them back in the box and then doing it again.
That could have been a lot more embarrassing.
Yeah,
when it comes to things your mom could discover.
Sure, I could have been nude. But she was like, she heard the noise and came into the room, and she was, you know, and I was halfway through pouring this money over my head, and she was like, what is the matter with you? And she was right.
Did you get a lesson about materialism?
It could have been peanut butter, which would have also been weird. No, I think my mom understood that I was always interested in money. And money because of what it represented, right? And money because of its potential energy, rather than my sister, who is interested in it as kinetic energy.
If future links don't have legal tender currency in their era, if they don't have this kind of instrument, we should emphasize for them how important it is for children who have no way to get it. You know, adults like money as well, but children fetishize it, and rightly so. They have no earning power, and this is their only means to any kind of independence.
And they see it as power, and it is.
I just had this flash. I haven't thought about this in decades. My hidey hole for my allowance was my parents had bought this Asian medicine chest that had a million little drawers. Mm-hmm. I think you put your ginseng in one, and put your ginger in. You know, have you seen these?
Oh, of course.
They have Chinese characters on
those apothecary boxes.
But this particular one had two drawers at the bottom that were hidden behind sliding panels.
Right. Secret drawers.
Secret drawers.
And did you have to do a little thing? Did you have to open another drawer halfway in order to be able to open the secret drawers?
If only. Yeah. No, it was a very limited Batcave scenario. You just had to slide out the panel. And there were two of these, and me and my brother each got one, and my sister is probably still angry to this day.
She's keeping her money
that
in her
she
mattress.
She didn't get a secret drawer. Wow. I wonder if that's still in that drawer at my parents' house.
Wait a minute.
Let's all go look for the hidden treasure. This omnibus is canceled.
My grandmother reportedly kept her money under the corners of her oriental carpets that were spread around her house. So when she died, My family went in and was rolling up the carpets, and there was stacks of money under all the corners.
I mean, the problem with this kind of old person scheme is that often if they don't tell anyone their scheme, the money gets thrown away.
That's right.
I think Mindy's grandma had kept a ton of money just in pages of books.
Yeah.
And a lot of those books probably just went to the Goodwill.
There are, I think right now, there's a collection in the U.S. Treasury somewhere of, you know, thousands of safe deposit boxes. When banks would fail, they would surrender their safe deposit boxes to the Treasury as part of their assets. And people, and you know, the Treasury made it available to for people to claim, but they just, you know, never did. Or their, you know, people would find when their grandfather died the key to the, some safe deposit box, and it wouldn't be labeled.
Yeah, and nobody knew. Like one person knew there was a few thousand dollars.
So who knows what? Who knows what precious?
This is my
rubies.
New screwball idea for canceling the deficit.
Oh.
Is we just nationalize all the security safety deposit boxes. In fact, if you haven't looked in your safety deposit box for 3 years.
Ouch, this is some Bernie Sanders law.
I'm just going to nationalize all the safety. Like if you haven't looked for 3 years, it now belongs to Uncle Sam.
I definitely feel like nationalized safety deposit boxes from 26 years ago, yeah, absolutely. But like 3 years, I mean, that's the point of a safe deposit box. You don't go look at
it. I just want to incentivize people going into the bank.
Oh, right.
It's an exciting Jason Bourne-like moment.
Go to the
when,
bank.
When you ask for your safety deposit box, and I want people to have that more.
And you have some like laser tattoo. That has your account number.
That's exactly what I want.
Well, you know, money, and I think a lot of our contemporaries know this, but maybe futurelings don't. Money used to be tied to actual, you know, things that had that human
inherent
beings
value.
Perceive to have inherent value. Right? Gold has no more real value other than scarcity.
Yeah, scarcity
of anything else. And if you make money or Bitcoin scarce, it has just as much.
Do you think the value. Beauty of gold is inherent, or will future species find basalt the most beautiful element, and they'll be trying to strain out the gold so they can get to whatever they think looks better?
Gold is rare. Gold is hard to get. Gold is beautiful. It's soft and it's a workable metal.
It's workable, so it's useful for.
It's very useful, and it has a lot of industrial uses, but also it's very decorative as an adornment. And also, I just think we all
not a lot of things are yellow. Lots of gray. In the ground,
right?
Lots of black and lots of brown.
Sunlight is yellow, according to the crayon theory.
We all know the crayon theory of optics.
The crayon theory.
Here's the craziest thing about the crayon theory to me. This is very much a side note.
Go ahead.
If you've ever noticed in Crayola crayons, yellow orange is more orange than yellow, whereas orange yellow is more yellow than orange. The dominant color goes second after the hyphen.
Whoa.
Which strikes me as madness.
The dominant color goes second.
You'd think an orange-yellow would be orange with a bit of yellow, but the implication is that it's a slightly orangish yellow. The second thing dominates.
So it's like west by north. It's not. It's north by west north.
Exactly.
Or west by north.
At least those directions are exactly between north by northwest.
Right.
It would be like as if saying northwest were a little more westy.
Sure.
That's west by northwest. Whereas west north is a little more northy.
Oh, west north. He was one of the great character actors on Sex and the City, but. At a certain point, of course, you don't want to carry gold around in your pockets because it jingles and it makes your jeans wear weird.
As I've said.
Right. And so
inconvenient.
So it was a long time ago, people recognized that if you made money look like paper, if you made money out of paper, rather, you could keep your gold somewhere else and the paper would be representative of gold.
The paper's a promise.
The paper
says, I have gold. And it has to do it in some way that you can't just go home and make 100 of them that say, I have gold.
Right. And banks would say, we have gold, and here is a piece of paper that that entitles you to ownership of this gold that we're going to keep for you.
Do you still say this when you buy a latte or whatever?
I do.
Do you slap down a $10 bill and say, I have gold?
Well, I do not, because a dollar bill no longer represents gold held anywhere. And we'll get to that in a minute, but, for a long time, and this hasn't always been true. I mean, precious metals were used for as money in their own sake. And then, for a long time, they were backed by gold and silver and precious metals. But opinions have varied about opinions among economists. And we know how opinions among economists are. If you put if you put 10,000 opinions by economists in one hand and you go poo-poo in the other.
This is how you know economics is for sure a real science, because they cannot even agree on the most basic elements of their own field.
But for a long time, gold and silver were instruments or were metal that on a one-to-one basis backed paper money. So a $50 bill was worth $50 worth of gold.
And that would give you some kind of certainty that even if, you know, even if something instability happened to the paper, we don't have to worry because there's still a room full of gold somewhere.
Right. But the problem with that, of course, is that that a government with a central bank that is full of gold has a finite amount of gold, limited by the amount of gold they have.
Wouldn't some economists say that's a feature, not a bug?
Well, it is until people want that gold back. And also it is a problem in that governments can't create money, right? And so what the limitation on the amount of available money does is it creates a scarcity of money, which when economies are growing, that limitation on money creates deflation, which is the opposite of inflation, right?
The money's worth too much.
Money's worth too much. And in particular, in instances where there's an economic panic and people say, okay, I no longer totally believe in this paper money. I would like my gold, please. And there's any kind of run on a bank that it actually involves taking gold out or using gold as an instrument in foreign policy, or, you know, repaying your debts with gold, using gold to buy goods and services or, you know, exchange between governments. That's real gold that no longer is available to back the cash that is in circulation.
Think of the inefficiencies of postage and delivery alone.
Right.
I want my gold back. Well, sir, your gold is very heavy.
It's very heavy.
It's going to take 6 weeks on the Wells Fargo wagon, and you're going to owe us like an additional $1,290 in postage.
That's right.
That's a lot of money.
But
so today we think of money no longer as being backed by precious metals, but just it's backed by the idea that governments are so important that some popular shared hallucination about them will guarantee their continued survival. Is that right?
Right. I mean, governments can produce more money when they need it, but there's an acknowledgement, at least, that you will, if you have one of the major currencies, that you have to reveal how much money you're printing. You can't just have a secret printing press somewhere that's pouring money into circulation. So, I mean, I think if you are in a developing nation that or a nation that's experiencing widespread inflation, you are printing money hand over fist, but that money is not then considered trustworthy on the international market. And for many, 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 many years, the currency that a lot of economies were pegged their own money to was the U.S. dollar, and that was because there was some considerable sense that the American economy was and the American dollar were instruments of trade that were going to remain robust.
Do you remember the news stories in it's around 2008, the hyperinflation in Zimbabwe? Zimbabwe had a less reliable dollar.
Considerably less.
To the extent that in November 2008, inflation hit a rate of 79.6%. I mean, we shouldn't laugh because if you're in Zimbabwe,
that's pretty bad.
It makes it very hard to take your wheelbarrow full of billion-dollar Zimbabwean bills to the store in order to buy one can of corn.
Sure, it makes Weimar Germany look like the model of stability.
That was their goal, I think. They wanted to make Weimar. That was Mugabe said, I want Weimar Germany to look better.
Well, often, I mean, when I was in Bulgaria in the late 90s, there was a kind of transition happening where the Bulgarian leva, they were printing new versions of it where they just took a bunch of zeros off of it. So 10,000 leva became one leva, And those,
did somebody with a Sharpie actually physically change the bill?
No, the new bills were beautiful. Oh. But it was a way of just saying like, okay, let's, and you know, and at the same time in Turkey, I mean, you would go to the ATM and take out 100,000 lira bills, and you know, you feel like you're really, basically I would go back to my hotel and just pour them over my head.
See, this is perfect for you. At one point, apparently Zimbabwe printed a $21 trillion bill.
A $21 trillion bill.
I think coincidentally they had $21 trillion of debt to the IMF. And look, they just found this sitting around.
Oops.
I think in general practice, I think there was at least plans for a $50 and $100 trillion bill.
Wow.
I just want to move to Zimbabwe and become a trillionaire.
Well, a lot of this... in the United States, at least, came to a head during the Great Depression. During World War I, there was a lot of exchange of money on an international scale. A lot of gold changed hands. Most of the major nations had their money pegged to gold, but gold was not freely traded as a commodity during this time. The price was somewhat fixed. And so the fact that there was a limited amount of gold and currencies were pegged to it, they could sort of trade against each other, but gold had a fairly constant price of about $20 an ounce.
Was this kind of an artificial price?
It was an attempt on the part of economists in general to keep when gold was used as coinage, you couldn't have a situation where gold also had a speculative value.
That's true.
Right? A $20 gold piece couldn't also be worth $50 worth of gold.
Or everyone will just melt down their $20 gold piece.
Right. So there was the idea of it having fixed value was sort of intrinsic to it being a unit of exchange. But during the Great Depression, there was, the value of money. There was this deflation where money became much scarcer, and there was a desire to kind of hoard it, because in particular hoard gold as a if you had money, right? Mm-hmm. If you were rich, as a bulwark against the collapse of the economic system. It was a fraught time, and by the time FDR was elected president in 1932, by the time he took office in 1933, there had been several runs on the banks. People wanted their gold now. They no longer had faith in the banking system.
Your money's not in here. It's out there. It's in your house, Mrs. Smith, and it's in your house, Bob. That's what happens when you try to get your money out of the bank.
That's nice. I like that.
You cancel George Bailey's honeymoon.
But you know, there were banks that would banks love to describe the situation when they close and bolt their doors. They call it a bank holiday. The bank takes a holiday.
I mean, if I was an employee, I would call it that too. Sweet, I'm going home early.
There are, 10,000 people in the street with torches and pitchforks, but you're taking a holiday. And there were a lot of banks in the country were taking these forced holidays because they were there.
It's like Chick-fil-A not having the sandwiches. Popeyes.
Right? Popeyes.
Popeyes doesn't have the sandwiches. They got to close their doors.
You know, I was driving in White Center and I saw a Popeyes, and I don't normally run into a Popeyes. Although there's that Popeyes in the Atlanta airport.
Yes.
That I see all the time, but I never quite have the guts to go over to it.
They are creeping north into Seattle gradually. The Popeyes line used to end in Renton, but.
But there's a Popeyes in White Center, and I actually had heard the hullabaloo about these chicken sandwiches, and I went and got in the drive-through line. And when I came up to the speaker, there was a handwritten sign taped to it that said, "We don't have any chicken sandwiches, so don't ask."
Think about that during the Depression. You go to the bank, you just want to check your safety deposit box like a good American, and there's a note taped to the teller window that says, "Just one thing you got to know, we don't have any money." Except for that, everything's good.
Well, so Roosevelt took office in March of 1933 because that was the style of the time.
He was the last president to do so, right? It was moved to January sometime when he was president?
Yeah, yeah. March was still the, you know, because they needed, back then, they needed time for the Pony Express to take all the documents around, get everybody to sign off on it.
You needed to tell the winner. Like, often it would take weeks to find out you won the election.
You've won, sir!
Good news, Zachary Taylor. Somebody shows up, Ed McMahon shows up with a giant check.
But Roosevelt, one of the first things he did when he took office was he declared a nationwide bank holiday of 7 days and said, all banks are closed. We need to talk amongst ourselves. We need to get this straightened out.
It's like you're going to recess early because somebody threw up.
And during that bank holiday, he issued what was called Executive Order 6102, which made it illegal for private citizens to own gold.
Whoa.
You could not have gold.
And you're telling me about Bernie Sanders style overreach.
Yes.
Did people freak out?
Well, it was illegal to freak out, as is true in all socialist economies. But it was now mandatory that you surrender your gold to the U.S. government.
Wasn't this criticized by big men with watch chains and many chins?
Well, it was criticized by, I mean, there were certainly conspiracy theories of all kinds, but it was sort of universally understood. And this is 1933. The economy is absolutely collapsing. Everyone is wringing their hands and clutching at their watch chains because the threat, and I think the global threat, is that economics as we know would be turned upside down.
It's the end of civilization. So people are happy about any plan? It's a lifeline.
This was a plan, and it was to combat. Well, it was to combat this problem, which was that gold. I mean, as gold drained out of the national coffers
into mattresses,
it made it more and more difficult to have money that was available to even repair the damage of the economic collapse.
Like transactionally, like business could not be done.
Right. So Roosevelt implemented this new policy, which was that you needed to surrender your gold, and the government would buy it at $20 an ounce, the generally agreed upon price. But all the major places where gold was stockpiled, all the people that had 5,000 ounces stored in under their bed, that all became illegal. And it was, and all the scrap gold, all your
bad ingots,
yeah, all your granddad's fillings, it was all included. I guess you could. Coin collectors could keep coins that were that had intrinsic value.
I love that the powerful coin collectors lobby has put a loophole in the law.
And you could keep, you know, I think up to 5 ounces of incidental gold.
Which counts jewelry, right?
Yeah.
FDR's not coming for your engagement ring.
He doesn't want your engagement ring. But beyond that, any sort of amount of gold that you had as a financial safety. Mm-hmm. And there were several people that were prosecuted for keeping... for keeping large quantities of gold, but you know, 5,000 ounces or something in there.
Patriots, I call them.
That's right. Well, and this law actually was passed under the tenets of the Aid to Foreign Governments Act. In 1917, there was an act passed called the Trading with the Enemy Act.
The TWTEA?
Yes. And this, this was all kind of under the less defined parts of the Trading with the Enemy Act, which was, you know, you're not allowed to hoard cash.
Because it makes you some kind of suspicious possible agent.
That's right, possible agent. And then, and so I think most of the monetary crowd, the monetary caste, supported this act on Roosevelt's part, even though now it seems like it would be a conservative bugbear. At the time, that combined with the bank holiday sort of stopped the run on gold and you know, put a patch on this problem. And then in a very canny move, some might say, Roosevelt by fiat, having bought everyone's gold at $20 an ounce, by fiat, he said, gold is now worth $35 an ounce.
Did he have economists telling him that this would not make trouble? That that was closer to a fair market value?
Well, what it did was it took the gold that the U.S. government had bought at $20 an ounce and made it worth $35 an ounce. And what that is effectively it is a devaluation of the dollar.
Yes,
which is a thing that governments do in times of crisis. They make their currency worth less, and then it has, there's more of it available. So this was a little bit of a switcheroo, but it worked. It created an enormous, it basically out of thin air created an enormous amount of money for the U.S. government to employ.
And inflation is not going to be a problem because the problem up till then has been scarcity.
Right. And gold is still not a tradable commodity.
Right. It's possible that $20 per ounce was crazy, right? That people would have been willing to pay much more, and this is a more realistic valuation.
Well, anytime you put a thing that's like induced demand, anytime you put a thing out on a commodities market, it's going to fluctuate and maybe was worth quite a bit more than $20 an ounce, even for industrial purposes. But $35 an ounce, it was still dictated that that was the price, and U.S. money was still redeemable. It wasn't redeemable in the sense of it. You couldn't go to the bank and get gold. Gold was illegal, but the money still was backed by the gold. And during this same period, European economies in the mid-1930s, European economies were also under tremendous stress, but then also the rise of Nazism and the general instability in Europe meant that a lot of European governments no longer felt safe with their own gold deposits, their own gold stockpiles. And so there was a lot of movement of gold globally to the United States.
Like, hold on to this for us?
Hold on to this for us.
In case something happens.
For instance, the Federal Reserve Bank in New York City, which even still holds tremendous stockpile of gold, most of that gold belongs to other governments. And the Federal Reserve actually holds their gold and doesn't charge them a fee. It's like, we'll hold your gold as like a kind of a bank favor. They charge money to move it around.
It's like the toaster you get to open an account.
Yeah. I mean, if you ask them to take 100 bars and send it back or move it over here, the feds will charge you like a shipping and handling fee.
To get it to Shanghai.
But it's just a little bit of professional courtesy between giant economies that you can keep your gold in the USA.
It's like a safety deposit box.
It is.
I don't want to be macabre here, but is New York City really the safest place you want to keep your money? Like, of any place on earth that could be the center of some kind of terrorist attack? I mean, I'd rather put my money in Aberdeen, South Dakota.
Well, you make a good point. And by the late 30s, that point was being taken by the people in power, who recognized that although we had now a tremendous stockpile of gold, it was being kept in buildings in New York, Philadelphia, and San Francisco. And the sense at the time was that these were vulnerable to foreign invasion. We weren't thinking in terms of natural disaster, but this was a time of political instability globally.
Sure.
And keeping
that's the part of America closest to the Nazis.
Well, and San Francisco being closest to the Japanese.
Right.
So the idea, it still hadn't been quite worked out by policymakers how difficult it would be to invade the United States. It seemed like, well, if you can invade Czechoslovakia, how much harder is it to mount a massive invasion of the USA? So—
Maybe they'd seen Red Dawn. They think it's super easy.
Red Dawn 1 or Red Dawn 2?
And I'm looking right now. I did not know where the Federal Reserve Bank is, but it's 10 minutes from the 9/11 attacks, yeah. The worst terrorist attack on U.S. soil.
Well, and in fact, during 9/11, there was a lot of bullion stored in the World Trade Center.
Oh, interesting.
And after the collapse of the World Trade Center, as they were digging it out, there was, you know, I guess Deutsche Bank had a lot of gold.
There were international observers on hand trying to make sure they got the right amount of gold back.
Yeah, they needed to dig all that out. And, you know, as the fire department were throwing blue jeans into their fire trucks. Sorry.
Wait. Is it the position of this program that the heroic 9/11 firefighters were stealing blue jeans?
Have you never seen those photos?
No, I haven't.
After the buildings collapsed, they found a fire truck that was that had been crushed under the building, and when it was revealed, it was full of looted blue jeans.
Oh, wow! Now I'm crushed.
That the firemen, I guess, were, as they were, you know, evacuating people, they were also sort of evacuating the gap.
Oh, man.
Pretty bad. But you know, that's neither confirmed nor denied by external sources. That might have all just been a hologram. Yeah. As we know, a lot of the 9/11 attacks were
maybe you dreamed
holograms. So it was authorized. It was understood at the time that we needed to protect our gold. And so they cast about looking for a place to build a secure facility. They picked Fort Knox in the great state of Kentucky.
Which was already some kind of army installation?
Fort Knox had been an army base for a long time. It was a fairly contested spot during the Civil War. It was the confluence of the Salt River and the Ohio River, I think. Hmm. But it was a place where a lot of battles, it changed hands during the Civil War. It had been an army base for quite a while.
Named for Henry Knox, the first U.S. Secretary of War.
Well, it wasn't during this period. It was.
It's a reverse naming.
It was named. I guess it was named Fort Knox, right about this time, 1932. So right before, during the Hoover administration, the name had changed.
What had it been?
It was Fort Duffield during the Civil War.
Duffield for all our troops out in Duffield?
Yo, yo, yo. It was named for Duffield.
I don't know who Duffield is.
Yeah, but Duffield was like a sort of a colonel or it was named for a reverend who was the father of a colonel. It used to be a much lower standard who could get a military base name?
It was just some guy in the quartermaster's office who had to file a paperwork or who said, oh, we'll put it over here by the river.
It's sort of like the little creek that's on my property. I'm really considering trying to name it name it Creek Morgan after myself after my great grandmother.
You absolutely should do that.
Well, I think the city actually.
Is there a name?
I think they have a name for it. They just don't enforce it.
Is there any reason it should not be Omnibus Creek?
If I put a sign up that said that, Omnibus Creek, I don't know who is going to tear it down. Most of my neighbors are all 95. You know, when the new neighbors move in, when the young people come.
Well, 95-year-olds are very change resistant.
They are.
You're going to find out what they called the creek when they were little.
Yeah.
And it might have been a crick.
That's Mud Crick. No, the guy across the street called it a crick two days ago.
Wow.
When he was telling me that that old Chicago, the Chicago Ed was crazier than a March hare.
Down Chicago. This is a big news about Chicago Ed coming out on the show.
So Fort Knox was chosen, and it had been called Camp Knox, I guess, during the period during World War One. And then it was the place that the army started to consolidate its mechanized armor units as tanks became a bigger part of army war making technology. Camp Knox and then Fort Knox became the headquarters of U.S. armor. And it was where, you know, Patton made his bones. And that was part of the appeal of locating our gold reserves there because
surrounded by
tanks.
Yeah.
And we were still trying to protect it and imagined that the real threat to it was that someone would invade the United States. And getting to Fort Knox, Kentucky, would be quite a job. You'd have to get over those Appalachians.
Also, no cat burglars there. Manhattan's got to be crawling with gentlemen jewel thieves.
But there are Goldfingers everywhere.
As we know, Goldfinger's tentacles extend even into the bluegrass of Kentucky.
But they set about building this this very secure facility, a building made out of North Carolina granite that with a vault constructed by the Mosler Company, sitting out in the middle of a basically a barbed wire protected minefield.
Yeah,
that was going to be the location of our goal.
Scrooge McDuck stuff.
It really
gotta
was.
Keep the Beagle Boys out.
In 1937, over a 5 month long period, they moved this gold in 39 separate trains, 215 different train cars from Philadelphia to Fort Knox. And a big part of this is because gold is heavy. I don't know if you know this about it.
That's the main problem I'm seeing here.
So a train car full of gold would not be a train car stacked to the roof with gold. That would be not movable. I mean, it's, you know, you to fill up a train car with gold, you're talking about kind of two pallets of gold.
And then hobos.
And then you're surrounded by hobos. And as you know, foreign governments cannot penetrate a scrim of hobos.
Most of the hobos are Pinkertons. I know that's one one issue with like I know Fort Knox on the inside looks nothing like it does in Goldfinger.
Right.
And that's the problem. There's no big stacks of gold because, you know, gold's just too heavy and unwieldy to have a big room stacked with it. You know, you've got a series of rooms with a small amount of gold each because that's the amount you can lift.
Well, in fact, the entire space in Fort Knox dedicated to storing gold is only about 4,000 square feet.
Disappointing.
4,000. Now, how
the size of a suburban home?
How big is your house?
Exactly. That's a McMansion sized Fort Knox.
I mean, not even a big McMansion,
no.
Right? 4,000 square feet is a suburban house. So you can put an awful lot of gold in a pretty small area.
That's good to know. If I ever have to put all the gold in Fort Knox in my house, I can probably
get pretty close to it. Although it would collapse your floor and also sink into the earth. Like the reason the Federal Reserve Bank is used for the Federal Reserve Bank in New York is used to store that much gold is that the foundation of that building is built on
Manhattan.
It's built on bedrock,
unmovable bedrock,
and so it's really one of the only buildings in the world that has a foundation strong enough to hold that much gold.
So is Kentucky gradually sinking into the
Fort Knox mantle? It has incredibly thick concrete and rebar construction within this sort of granite super architecture. But this was, as I say, during a period and right before World War II, countries were bringing their gold to the United States, but also the U.S. through its whole project of making gold illegal and collecting gold. Our reserves had grown by a significant margin. Now, all the gold that we collected from regular people and the gold that we were continuing to mine and the gold that we were – that used to be meant for consumers that had been scrapped really only constituted, you know, a fairly small amount of the gold in the world. We only gained 6 million ounces by this buyback program, and we had about 25 million ounces through other sources. But between the period of 1933 and 1941, our gold reserves went as follows. In 1933, we had about 194 million ounces of gold in the United States when Roosevelt passed this order.
Mm-hmm.
By 1940, that had become, well, by 1937, after this initial, you know, buyback period,
5 years after that,
we had almost twice as much gold, 350 million ounces. But by 1940, because of this capital flight from Europe, we had 635 million ounces of gold.
And we've discussed this on the gold hats entry, that the amount of gold in the world is not an eye-popping amount. You could fit all the gold that exists on Earth into a cube, right, of size 20 meters long.
Right. And by the beginning of World War II, we possessed 80% of the world's gold reserves here in the United States.
Wow. In Kentucky, of all places, by the ones that was moved?
Not all of it was in Kentucky. Oh, there's okay. Still there was still a lot kept other places, but we had a tremendous what pile, I guess, of it.
I think that's the technical term.
And during the war, Fort Knox was Fort Knox became what it is today, kind of a euphemism for something for a place that is incredibly safe. And so
it's like Fort Knox in there.
It's like Fort Knox at Fort Knox.
If I was a soldier in there, every time I went on duty, I'd be like, whoa, it's like Fort Knox
in here.
It's
really like Fort Knox.
At the moment, I'm limited to doing that in Grand Central Station in New York.
You know, it's like Fort Knox in here?
Yeah, I say it's like Fort Knox in here.
Why is Grand Central Station, which is absolutely full of people and has doors on all sides, anything like Fort Knox?
No, when I'm in Grand Central Terminal and it's very busy, I turn to whoever I'm with and I say, wow, it's like Grand Central Station in here.
Oh, I see.
And they think it's hilarious.
You are such a dad.
It's yeah. I actually did this with my daughter last week,
and
she was.
Does she know enough to roll her eyes at you?
It was audible, even in a noisy train terminal. You could hear the eye rolling.
At this point, the fear that we were vulnerable to being invaded or attacked from overseas meant that the Library of Congress and the sort of U.S. archives also wanted a big Fort Knox built for themselves because they wanted
just for documents and such
for all of our great, you know, the patrimony of the United States and the fact that we were also holding a lot of like, for instance, we were given the crown of Saint Stephen and the royal jewels of the Kingdom of Hungary.
Oh.
Because the Hungarians said, will you hold on to this for us?
You've seen what's going on with Germany and Russia.
And Russia. It just seems like maybe you could hold the crown of St. Stephen for a while. It's kind of important to us.
So we had the crown of St. Stephen.
We did, among other things.
We gave them a piece of paper that said, I owe you one crown of St. Stephen.
But the federal government would not authorize the construction of a giant archive somewhere in the mine and hills of Dakota. Mm-hmm. And so so some attempt was made to, you know, take some major part of Fort Knox for the, you know, the use of the Library of Congress and the U.S. archives. Fort Knox, because it was controlled by the Treasury and protected by the Army, at first offered the archive something like 5 square feet of floor space.
Is that right?
And then it was extended to like 50 square feet, you know, when people complained. And so during World War II, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, you know, the notes for Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, a copy of the Magna Carta, wow. You know, all these documents that we had that were, that we felt needed to be preserved, that were, you know, sacred, our sacred documents. We're all encased in these hermetically sealed copper frames and very much like the end of Indiana Jones, wheeled out to Fort Knox and kept there.
Much to the consternation of Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, that's right. Well, no, I mean, the real documents were kept in a strangely subterranean cave underneath a gas station somewhere.
It's like Saddam Hussein. You got a bunch of fake constitutions out there. With slightly different amendments to confuse the eye and befuddle the viewer.
Yeah, all this stuff was protected by what really is an impenetrable structure. Like the door itself is 21 inches thick.
Ooh, it's like the Tron door.
It is. It's on a lock system that it's locked. Every time you lock it, it's locked for 100 hours mandatory.
It's inconvenient.
The mint...
If you leave your hat in there or something.
Well, let me get to that. The Mint employees, in order to enter it, two separate employees have to put in two separate combinations that only they know at, you know, at one removed from one another, kind of like the nuclear codes.
Right.
There is an escape tunnel.
Mm.
But it's only unlockable from inside. And you can only unlock it from inside if the big door is locked.
This is an emergency situation.
In case you lose your hat in there and you realize, oh, my hat, and you run back in and then the door locks for 100 hours.
Dr. Manhattan problem.
There is a little bit of an escape route.
What if it's an odd job style hat?
Still, I don't think it'll get through that 21-inch door. You know, the Fort Knox, it doesn't need to be a secret location because it's so well guarded that the sort of public – knowledge of it maybe even works in its strengths. It's located at the intersection of Bullion Boulevard and Gold Vault Road. So they're not making a big attempt.
It's like when a stadium gets renames its road after the Hall of Famer or whatever. Bullion Boulevard. Come on.
So during this whole period, and then after the war, you know, Fort Knox has become kind of a place where we store stuff that seems both valuable and also vulnerable.
Like me.
Valuable and vulnerable. So during the 50s, we saw, I think, the U.S. government, and we talked about this during the Cold War.
That's where we stored our Mouseketeers.
We stored a bunch of morphine. And
wait, what?
Yeah, we took our whole reserve.
We were so worried about juvenile delinquency that we moved all our needle drugs to Fort Knox.
It wasn't that. We had a sense that in the event of a catastrophe, we wouldn't have enough opium and morphine to treat the injured and to treat the chronically in pain. So a recognition that morphine and opium were of vital national security interests meant that that we started to store an enormous stockpile of it. What ended up being 68,000 pounds, or enough opium and morphine to kill the pain for the entire country for a year. Because poppies and opiates are only, and at that time even more so, those are only grown in certain kind of unstable parts of the world.
Right.
And if conflict and invasion and war,
America cannot grow its own opium poppies.
No, and if the supply of those things were cut off, it represented, yeah, it was a national security issue. So we stockpiled these drugs.
Did they change the name of the roads to like Heroin Highway and Painkiller Place?
There's already a Heroin Highway, and it's outside of Kandahar. And we continued to stockpile that stuff into the 90s. Because, of course, once you have a bunch of morphine and opium, it's not like the government can then sell it when it no longer needs it, right? There's no market. There's no open market for that stuff.
Does it go bad like Advil? Like,
well, they started converting it into morphine sulfate, which is a more stable. Huh. You know, I think if it just sits around, right, it gets cheese mold on it and you can't use it. Or maybe it gets even hotter.
I'm not shooting up with that.
Maybe it becomes even better. But the gold standard and the fact that our money was tied to gold and to quantities of gold, you know, that worked, except that when the United States possessed so much of the world's gold, it really started to limit other countries' ability.
Well, make them a little antsy. It sure gives us a lot of power to essentially turn off the faucet.
It sure does. And it made the U.S. dollar the major sort of currency by a fair margin. And so
even though it was one of the uglier currencies,
it was not as beautiful as the Gilda.
Weird,
for sure.
Weird monochrome green paper,
or even the Swiss franc, very beautiful money. So in the 1960s, European governments first started to rebel against the US sort of being the currency that all other currencies were pegged to. And
so in those countries, Goldfinger is the hero.
Well, James Bond is the villain. And it was West Germany that first sort of peeled off and said the Deutschmark is no longer going to play this game. And it was very successful for them. The Deutschmark became now a more valuable, a more volatile currency, but one that – and so that started a little bit of a trend that countries were going off the gold standard and their currencies became sort of tradable, basically commodities. In August of 1971, Richard Nixon, no less than Richard Nixon, as part of a sort of sweeping reform of the economy, took the United States off of the gold standard.
So late, right?
71 was fairly late.
We think of the gold standard, I think of the gold standard as kind of a, you know, William Jennings, Bryan era controversy, but it took Nixon to go to Kentucky, I guess.
It did. Yeah. Oh, when Nixon went to Kentucky, right? And it couldn't have been a Democratic president. And this really was, this did throw sort of deficit hawks and conservatives and conspiracy theorists into a tizzy. Because, of course, if your money is no longer backed by anything other than the reputation of the U.S. government and the general, you know, the sort of – talk about establishing the price of gold by fiat. Now we're just saying this money is worth what it's worth.
If there's anybody I didn't trust the reputation of the U.S. government to, it's Richard M. Nixon. What could go wrong?
Well, what could go wrong? Gold was still not a tradable commodity until Gerald R. Ford in 1974 made it, and this may seem crazy, but it wasn't until 74 that you could legally own gold as a private citizen. And so
that's why I chose that year to be born.
So Ford said, sure, go ahead and own gold. And initially gold was still sort of at $35 an ounce. You know, it took a while for it to gain in price.
What is gold? What is the price of gold today in our era? Just to give the futurelings a benchmark.
The price of gold today is $1,475 an ounce.
Well, that would be a little more.
And a lot of that happened, a lot of that price inflation happened during the financial crisis in 2007, 8, and 9. In 2004, you could buy an ounce of gold for about $450. And it sort of crept up during the run-up to the financial crisis. It was $600 in 2006. I mean, this drives me crazy, of course, because in 2006, I had $600.
In gold?
I just had $600. Oh. I could have bought gold. in the 2007, it was worth $800. And then
you could have bought a lot of things.
I could have bought Bitcoin.
You could have bought Microsoft stock, or you could have bought Action Comics number one.
Maybe in 2007, Microsoft stock wouldn't have been
2007
that big of an investment.
Okay, in 2007, you could have bought Amazon stock.
Yeah, that's true.
Or you could have bought.
Look, Bitcoin is the one.
The first appearance of some Marvel Comics character that later showed up in a movie.
Wouldn't care about that. But by 2011, gold had gone up to $1,900 an ounce, $1,895.
Is this the natural, normal response to people in times of economic crisis, or is this just late-night TV ads on Fox News scaring the boomers?
Well, because people think that gold has intrinsic value and that paper dollars don't. And if you recall, the hyperventilating Fox News take on it was that the financial crisis, the collapse of all those banks because of the mortgage crisis was going to result in a loss of faith in the American dollar and the euro, and it was going to result in a worldwide economic collapse, which was exactly what was sort of threatening the Roosevelt administration in 1933. But in 2011, we didn't have the option of changing the price of gold quite like we did.
The government can't buy all your dollars back.
So all these what are called gold bugs are people that feel like as the economy collapses, you can rely on gold as a container of wealth, even though. If it's a real zombie apocalypse,
yeah, like nobody's making jewelry or cell phones.
You show
anymore.
Up with a little bar of gold and say, "Give me some rice." I mean, the people with the last little bit of rice don't care about your gold.
You just shave it off with a pocket knife.
At present, it's still though about $1,500 an ounce, which is extraordinary amount of money to pay for gold.
It didn't drop.
Well, it dropped a little, but it's still twice the price it was only 10 years ago.
Interesting. I wonder what the future of that is, if there's a continued sense of instability that props that up, or if there's a generation that is holding on to the gold, and once they're gone, the price drops again. I wonder how much psychology plays a part.
Well, it's interesting to consider. Over the decades from our height at almost 650 million ounces of gold in Fort Knox, we're now a lot of that gold has gone to
China.
Well, we still keep a lot of foreign gold, but a lot of that gold has gone, yes, to gone to graveyards, every one. The gold has gone out into the world to fund American expansion, and also, right, it has been collected collected in other economies.
More growing, promising sectors.
So that Fort Knox today only has about 147 million ounces of gold.
And if we do the math, have we done the math?
That's, you know, that's even less gold than we had in 1933.
147 million ounces.
147 million ounces.
And an ounce of gold is worth, what did you say, $1,400?
$1,475. It's about $210 billion worth of gold, which is, or is that, has the price of gold fluctuated since I did that last calculation? Do you even have a computer that can calculate that amazing amount of money? We need a Cray computer.
I don't have enough zeros. I don't have enough pixels to make those zeros.
147 million times 1,475.
$216 billion. That's a pretty good. That'd be a pretty good haul if for a heist movie.
Although that would be a really, really
hard to fence.
Oh well, and super hard to like get on a semi truck and drive. Right. Every one of these bars, each gold bar weighs 400 ounces. And these gold bars are only 7 inches long and 3.5 inches wide. So
400 ounces.
It's
It's a pretty heavy barbell, whatever that is, 30 pounds or something.
Yeah, 30 pounds, right.
A little like, under 25 pounds.
It's like it would be harder than stealing a baby. But, you know, about equivalent to.
Quieter. Ingots aren't going to cry when you take them out.
No, but they do jingle and they do really sag your pants.
And that concludes Fort Knox, entry 493.2CH0913, certificate number 2504 in the omnibus. Now, futurelings, speaking of currencies that have become devalued over time, John and I posted abundantly on the social media of our era. Please don't judge us. We were at John Roderick and at Ken Jennings, for those who were interested in following us in our era. Jointly, we were the Omnibus Project. I was on Twitter, John was on Twitter and Instagram, and on TikTok, doing some of his famous TikTok dances. People loved that. We were available to receive emails at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. For people who wanted to send us physical items, do you want to send John the $600 worth of gold you bought in 2007? So he stops regretting that.
Please do. Just send me over the code to your Bitcoin wallet. That's all fake money anyway.
If you found a safety deposit key in your late uncle or grandparents' things, send us the key. We've got time. We will go to downtown banks and try the key in multiple safety deposit boxes until we find the weird souvenirs of his first girlfriend that he kept in there.
Hmm.
I don't know. What do you have a safety deposit box?
I used to, where I kept all my weird coins and bullion and other stuff, and then eventually
you can tell the distant future. Where do you keep your coins and bullion?
Use it as doorstops.
Right.
Yeah.
Famously so. Sad. Not coins.
Sad though. And weird. Yeah, coins in big bags that have dollar signs on them.
Well, that's just the wrong idea. People are immediately going to – you need to put a Z before the dollar sign. People will be like, well, that's a Zimbabwean dollar.
It's a Zimbabwean dollar. It's not worth anything.
These trillion-dollar bills are worth nothing. John probably uses those to stoke his fireplace. you can send us your safety deposit keys and, crucially, your Jack Chick tracts to our postal address, which was P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. If you did not buy gold, if you just kept cash on hand and you would like to contribute that to this endeavor, we gladly accept all pledges, which ensure that the omnibus continues right until the exact second that the world ends. You can send those to patreon.com/omnibusproject. Please congregate with other like-minded iguana squid hybrids, the iguanids, at the Futurelings Facebook page, or alternatively, here's kind of a hipster alternative. If you want to get ahead of the trend, you can go to the /Futurelings subreddit on reddit.com.
Get there. Get there before it's overrun with noobs.
Did I do all the stuff?
Think so.
Okay.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived, and that's why Ken and I are hoarding gold. We hope and pray that this catastrophe we fear may never come, because we don't like carrying gold around to buy basic necessities. And also, that seems like bad value for gold. I'm one of those people that would have a vest lined with gold, and that would cause me to drown in the river as I tried to ford it.
Ironically, nobody wants to die by irony.
That's such a Twilight Zone.
That's where the word irony comes from. There's a guy trying to cross a river carrying a bunch of iron, and he drowned.
If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.